This podcast is about your future. What if the next years of your life can be the best years of your life? When full-time work becomes optional, you'll have the time to do all the things you've always wanted to do, if only you had the time. And soon you will. But to make the most of it, you'll need to be well prepared, and that goes well beyond your financial planning. Each week, your host, Joe Casey, is inviting you into conversations with his guests to bring you insights, inspiration, and practical ideas to design your new life, a life you'll build around what matters most to you and on your own terms. Let's get started.
Thanks for joining us today. If you've listened before, you know that this podcast is primarily about the non-financial side of retirement. But I'd like once a quarter to invite a guest to talk about the other side, the financial side of retirement and later life. And today we have a guest who'll talk about it from another angle, and that's the angle of parenthood and grandparenthood. Now, that may not apply to everyone because many of our listeners don't have children, but if you do, you'll want to hear our guest. Bobby Rebell is a certified financial planner and host of the critically acclaimed Money Tips for Financial Grownups podcast. She's the author of the new book, Launching Financial Grownups, Live Your Richest Life by Helping Your Almost Adult Kids Become Everyday Money Smart. It's a call to action for parents of teenagers and young adults who want the best for their kids, but are beginning to realize their own financial independence and financial separation from their children has become a priority as well. Her first book was How to Be a Financial Grown-Up, Proven Advice from High Achievers on How to Live Your Dreams and Have Financial Freedom, and it was released in 2016. In 2017, she left her job as a global business news television anchor and personal finance columnist at Thomson Reuters to expand the Financial Grown-Up brand, and later that year, she obtained her CFP. Previously, Bobby had worked at CNBC, CNN, and PBS Nightly Business Report. She's a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and received her CFP from NYU. She lives in New York City with her husband, three kids, and one dog.
Bobby, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So the place I'd like to start is that you're in your own second act, for lack of a better term. Tell us about what you used to do and how you made the transition to what you're doing now.
So I spent most of my adult career as a, what I call a corporate journalist. So my first paid job was at CNBC. My first, I should say, unpaid job was at CNN. And I went through some amazing experiences at CNBC, at CNN. I worked at PBS for the Nightly Business Report, which sadly is no more, but it was a great show. And then I landed at the at Reuters, which was later became Thomson Reuters, where I eventually was the global business anchor based out of New York City. And I also wrote a globally syndicated personal finance column by the time I was done. And I had incredible experiences traveling all around, interviewing big name CEOs at the time, everyone from Bill Gates, Larry Ellison, Kevin O'Leary, Tony Robbins, all these amazing figureheads in the business. Notice mostly men, just of note, and some incredible women as well. But it was a great experience, but it was also all consuming. And especially as I was sort of, I turned down the promotion multiple times, but eventually I was sort of forced to be the manager. It got to a point where it was getting ridiculous. And my boss, and he was right. He said, look, you got to grow up, by the way. And that was part of, in my first book, How to Be a Financial Grown-Up, was inspired by Jack, who said to me, it's time to grow up. You have to be the manager. Like, I can't keep promoting people to be your boss that are like, not, it's not right. And it was all consuming because I found myself trying to get my kid to school in the morning. And I would literally get up hours before to prep for the bosses were in London. So you're prepping for an early meeting and you're not technically at work yet. And then you're on the meeting. Then I'm driving my son to school. Then I'm getting back home. Then I'm getting ready for work. Then I'm going and so on. You get the idea. And then you get home and it's 8 o'clock and technically you're home for bedtime, but you are just fried. And all you can do at that point, and granted a nanny's doing all the things my son was cared for, is just, you just want to get them to bed. You just want them to get to bed because you're so tired. You're not really mentally focused on anything. You have no idea what's going on in their life. And then the weekends are just a catch up on everything. So yeah, I guess it sounds like I was burning out. I, however, did really value my career and everything that I had accomplished. I didn't want to just quit. And so I, what I call a mentor tour, where I called up people that had been important in my life over the years, some people going back to college that I really hadn't spoken to much. And you feel weird cold calling people, but they loved it. And I got meetings with people. This is way before COVID. So in person was a really effective thing. I think it's really important to meet people in person if that becomes available again. And I got a lot of advice. And long story short, I came up with a brand concept called Financial Grown Up, which is about going through the different adulting milestones in life. And I wanted to do originally a documentary. I had an agent that advised me why that was not viable. And I ended up doing a book. And the book was successful enough, as I had been determined to do, that 6 months after the book came out, I was able to leave my job at Reuters and pursue a job as sort of an author and content creator, speaking engagements, emceeing conferences, working with different brands, and basically creating this sort of, I don't know what my business is, Joe, but every year I'm proud. I've always made more money than I did in my corporate job. So it's worked out. And now I have my second book and I love it. It's been great. I do want to say very quickly, I know that was a long answer. Part of the equation is that I have a very supportive husband who has income that we knew would be steady. And it's really important that people understand that I have that. I've also had his back. He's had his career's ups and downs too. But because I had that base of steady income, I was able to take that leap. And I think it's really important that I had a very supportive spouse. And I don't want to leave that out because it is not easy to do. And this is a retirement podcast. You would need a much bigger cushion than I had. I did have a cushion, by the way. I did build up a cushion, but that second income was everything with benefits, health insurance, yeah, so I mean, by benefits.
Are faced with all kinds of obstacles. We have many listeners who often write to me that many are not married and are going, yeah, going alone. Lots of challenges as well, but I appreciate your points. And your second book, I'm curious. I had the chance to read it. Thank you for that. What gets in the way of young adults achieving financial independence?
So it is the Wild West right now because there have been so many changes in our society. And you've addressed this and you had a great episode earlier. I encourage people to go back talking about the trends in the demographics. And that is really influencing the way that younger people are going through these adulting milestones. And that's all of what Financial Grown Up is about. I mean, my first book was How to Be a Financial Grown Up. This is launching Financial Grown Ups. And it's really about how we as a society approach where we're supposed to be at what time. A lot of this book, Launching Financial Grownups at the beginning, is dedicated to looking at, well, wait, really things actually are different for today's young people, the almost adults, let's call them. Many more are graduating with student debt. And by the way, many more parents have student debt. Let's not forget about that. They're also facing a gig economy. They also have, it's good and bad. They have the benefit of the Affordable Care Act, often known as Obamacare. That is a good thing overall for society. It really is. But the side, the sort of collateral damage of that is that companies then don't feel as much pressure to step up and provide those benefits for young people. My 25-year-old, when she started her job at a major consulting firm, was urged by them not to go on their insurance. They said, oh, go on your parents. It'll be better because they don't want to pay for it. Because remember, they're paying for a big portion when you're on corporate health insurance. So it's kind of given these companies a pass on giving our young people the full package of employment benefits, which is worth real money. We know that because when people retire, you lose that. So you know, this is a really big part of your compensation and our young people aren't necessarily getting that. And so yes, they have the freedom to explore different careers, work in the gig economy if they want, but it also forces them into unsteady careers and the gig economy, even if they don't want it. And so we as parents are left kind of as the stakeholders. I mean, people say schools should teach personal finance. Yes, they should. It's not an either or. But at the end of the day, it is we, the parents, the grandparents, the uncles, aunts, anyone who has an almost adult in their life that they care about that are left holding the bag to help them put piece together a financial life as a young adult. It is very complicated for them.
So one thing I've learned as a parent of adult children is that one obstacle can be that parents still think of and deal with their children, who are now young adults, as if they're still children. My now 32-year-old taught me this once a number of years ago, had a conversation about this, and I've worked on it since. But how can parents evolve the relationship with adult children?
So this is such a good question. And I'm going to share with everyone something I don't think I've talked about publicly yet. It's not in the book. It happened really recently. And it's an egg on my face moment, even though I actually wrote this book. Okay. So we're Jewish. The high holidays were coming up. And if you know anything about the way that synagogues work, there are tickets to attend services. So our family has been a member of a synagogue. It's a couple blocks away from us. My child went to nursery school there, going there forever. We haven't been there in person because of COVID for a while, but it looked like last summer that there were going to be in-person services. And so as I did in the before times, I, you know, wrote in, I said, we have 2 adults and 3 children. And they wrote back and they said, we will send you tickets for child 2 and child 3, but child number 1 needs her own membership. And I was like, why? And they pointed out that she was 24 at the time. And I sort of said, oh, okay. They said she's an adult and she needs her own membership. And intellectually, I understood. I mean, I'm still processing this now. Like, yes, of course, a 24-year-old is someone that would be an adult and would need to pay for her own membership. And yet at the same time, even my husband was like almost offended. He's like, well, what do you mean? She's my kid. You're saying we can't sit together as a family? Like, she has to buy a whole new, and it's not inexpensive. And they basically said, well, she's an adult. She's not in college. And they said, but she can call us, by the way, if it's not in her budget, because it is not inexpensive. And we're happy to find a price point that's right for her. They understood whatever the number was. They understood that that's not something a 24-year-old might be able to afford. But they're like, oh, we'll work with her. We'll come up with a number. But it was really interesting because a lot of this perception is more on us as adults. I want to be clear. Ashley was not in this conversation. She never said I should be treated like a child and given a free seat. She, you know, I brought it up to her. She's like, oh, maybe I'll consider joining. There's no, it wasn't on her. It was on us, the parents. We couldn't conceive that she's now 25, that she should be ticketed, that she buys an adult ticket. It's just, we are the problem in many cases. It really, it's a perception adjustment. And I think a lot adjusted during COVID too.
It's a shock to the system when you realize that, how did this happen? So here's a question for you. How should parents think about how long the bank of mom and dad should remain open?
So it's not a black or white question. This is not linear. It's not open, then closed. It's going to adjust and change. What I would say is the services that the bank of mom and dad are offering should adjust to the different appropriate life stages. So for example, you know, maybe when they're out of college, you can say, well, you can live at home for free and we're not going to charge you for groceries, but we expect you to have an exit strategy and share it with us. And as long as we are effectively paying your rent and all of your food and all of that, we get to see your finances, right? Just like a bank would be like, well, if we're going to lend you money or we're going to support you and provide financing, we are entitled to see these things. So no money unless there's transparency, number one. And number two, do things that make sense. So for example, one thing I talk about is the classic joke is like, are you on your parents' phone plan? In the book, I talk about Jason Pfeiffer, who I'd overheard on his podcast, him being teased by his co-host that he was still on his, he was 39 at the time, being teased by his co-host, you're on your parents, you're the head of Entrepreneur Magazine and you're on your parents' phone plan. Like, so I interviewed him and his father and like, it came out a whole logical thing. It was like, it was more of a joke among their family. It wasn't a need thing. So that's fine. And the truth is, to separate a kid from your phone plan, maybe it's $100 for them to be on their own plan and $25 to be on yours. So what you can do very easily is don't spend more money as a family. I talk about a concept of a family ecosystem. Never create expenses that are bigger just to kind of teach your kids a lesson. It's very easy. Just say, you know what? Just so you know, your portion of the phone bill is $25 a month. It would be silly to have your own phone line for $100. We're going to set up an auto pay where every month $25 goes from your account to my account. And that's it. So you can really adjust the way that you offer support. And I also think it's important if you have the resources, and that is a big if, because I don't want anyone taking retirement money out. But if you do, understand that you are in a life phase. Let's say you're retired or near retirement. You're not supporting your adult children, but you might have grandchildren. They are probably in a really tight, it's a tough time financially because they're not earning what you're earning and they've got all these expenses. It is great if you want to help with your grandchildren. Okay. That is not a bad subsidy. If you can help with your grandchildren's school or their camp and it doesn't impinge on you, because the time, you know, that people are having young kids, so much is coming at them and there's so much work stress, very often 2 incomes. There's nothing wrong with helping out a little, especially with extras, the nice to haves. What you don't want to have is your almost adults be dependent on you, where they're waiting for the check to pay their rent and they're not doing the adult things they need to do because they don't have to.
I'm pausing for laughter that our 3 daughters who listen to this podcast occasionally are probably embroiled in now listening to the phone plan discussion because we have lots of back and forth on that over the years.
Yeah, the phone is a thing. It's a thing.
It really is.
There was recently, did you see the Stephen Miller thing?
No.
I mean, the guy's, oh, Google it. The guy's under investigation. And it came up somehow, like, they subpoenaed his phone records. I mean, you know, and it comes up because they're subpoenaing his phone messages that he's on his parents' phone plan. Sure. And he's 36 years old. I forget his title, but he's an advisor to Trump and whatever. And he's on his parents' phone plan. And that's like the complication in the court case is the guy's on the parents' phone plan. He's like married with kids. Yeah, the phone's a thing.
So in parenting, timing matters. And there's a Buddhist saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. What have you found are some of the best times to engage with teenagers and young adults on this topic of financial independence?
The moment it matters to them. And that's the key thing. Something might matter to you, but if they're not ready, they're not going to hear you, right? So you can, a lot of parents want to help and they'll say, oh, you know, you're graduating. I'm going to introduce you to this person and this person. And they send these emails and then the kid doesn't follow up. Well, it doesn't matter enough to them yet. So you kind of need to give them the space to get to the point where they're going to actually benefit from your advice. You kind of have to wait to be asked to some degree. And that's a really hard thing to do because we think we know better. We often do know better. But if they're not ready for the message, they won't actually hear us and they won't act on it. So you have to give them a little space. And unfortunately, the way society is right now, they probably need more space than we did. And that's, again, it's good and bad because I look at my parents, my mother, she was basically forced to a job. She was a teacher. It's fine. But she had very limited prospects. She ended up becoming a lawyer later in life, but she was pigeonholed because, well, this is, you have to have the job and this is the, and you could do, she told me she could do a teacher or a flight attendant. And she was too short to be a flight attendant. So literally her only job choice was a teacher. And she was forced into that. My father, right out of college, what will you be? You will be a lawyer. Okay, there you go. Check the box. And then boom, there he goes. And by the way, he practiced law for like a nanosecond. And then he went into Wall Street. Fine. But we were forcing kids into things and they had to immediately be adults. That's not necessarily good. We've got the opposite thing now because we're not giving them enough kind of a push. We're just giving them, you know, it's almost like too many choices. What's that called? Decision fatigue. When you say you could be anything in the world. And I think that's great, but we also want to like help them say, okay, maybe if you're interested in this, you can do this. And maybe a little more emphasis on the profit side of their passion. So an example would be myself. My father, like I said, worked on Wall Street, wanted me to work on Wall Street. I wanted to be a journalist. Well, he said, tell you what, summer before graduation, why don't you get a job doing money-related journalism? And that way you'll learn about it and maybe you'll like Wall Street. And worst case scenario, you'll go into journalism, but at least financial journalism will pay better. It was, you know, journalism does not pay well, but if you're in money-related, you know, stock market coverage, these are jobs mostly with benefits, with stability, with, for me, I wanted to be in New York City. So they're in New York City. So it provided a lot of the stability that I think made my father more comfortable. And it was a nice compromise. So it's important to talk to your kids and have that, you know, sort of, okay, let's think through your passion, but you have to figure out how will this pay? And if it won't pay, then maybe they do something else for pay and find their identity in their passion. And that's okay. I mean, there's a reason a lot of chefs do not want to go home and cook. And sometimes doing your passion for pay ruins your passion. And we need to tell people that too. Like, it's not always what you think it's going to be.
Very true. So parents do play a big role, as you mentioned, but how can high schools and even perhaps colleges improve education on the practical aspects of financial literacy?
Well, first of all, they need to have it, but they also need to really make it mandatory. What I've heard from a lot of colleges, and this is anecdotal, is that they'll offer these courses, but people don't always sign up. They'll sign up for like the history of the Sopranos or whatever it may be. I'm probably dating myself with that. But there are, you know, a lot of courses that are very trendy. And I'm not going to say anymore because I don't want to put anything down because everything has its validation. But I know I took a lot of courses that would have been better off taking. Well, I did take economics, but, you know, more serious courses. And so maybe a little more focus on making that part of the mandatory core curriculum, because it is not something that people generally want to take unless they see themselves going into a career like that. And I think we need more emphasis on making sure they actually show up and take it and take it seriously. Very often when there's a speaker at college, they don't want to go see a financial speaker. So you need to somehow make it something that is not a choice. But the truth is also, I have to tell you, until, you know, going back to my other answer, you can learn things in a book, but until it matters to you, I mean, look, our now 25-year-old, I mean, she knew everything. I'm her mom. I mean, I'm her stepmom. I'm her mom. And she grew up with me, I should say. So my two oldest are stepchildren, but they grew up with us full time. Their mom, you know, happens to live in a different state. So I will sometimes, I mean, she's my daughter. And I will tell you, like, she knew everything. I was writing this book while this was happening. She had all the information. She thought she knew what she was going to get from her paycheck. Again, very good job, very high paying. Everything's good with her. The primal scream, Joe, when she got this paycheck and saw the taxes, the HSA, the 401k match that I made her sign up for, all the optional, you know, I'm big on even disability insurance, I think is important. There was a primal scream. So there's nothing bad about schools teaching this. But at the end of the day, this is why parents need to be there and need to make sure that their kids are tuned into the real life experiences of becoming financial grownups, because it's not the same on paper as it will be when you actually experience it.
There's no substitute for learning from experience and then having people you can talk to who can offer advice.
Yeah. Look, my stepson had to get renter's insurance. So I could have just said, you know, get renter's insurance. Well, first of all, it's just like, yeah, okay, he will tomorrow, always tomorrow. And then even when I said to get it, I mean, he would have just like taken the quote, maybe would have gotten two quotes. We were able to go in. I sat with him. I made sure he touched the keyboard and he was the one driving, as you say, and go through. And the company he used, they had a very nice user interface. You could figure out the four components that impacted what was the rate that you would pay and what were the benefits you would get. And so, for example, because I was sitting there and pushed him to do it and he had better things to do, trust me, so annoying. My stepmom sitting there making me deal with renter's insurance. And one of the components was that you pay, you know, X dollars and you get a certain amount of time in a hotel if something happens to your apartment, right? So let's say out of a $200 your quote, that was $50 of it. I said, well, they've priced in that you get 2 months in a hotel, but he goes to NYU. We live in New York City. So he would just come home and stay in his childhood bedroom. So I was like, well, let's just knock that to zero. Because if something happens, it's zero. So he did that. He's pressing the buttons. He paid on his own debit card. We did reimburse him. He's in college. We reimbursed him for that. He pays some expenses on his own. But now he knows how to not only how to purchase it, but how to purchase it thoughtfully. And I don't think there's any substitute for that. And I don't think he would have learned it at such a granular level in college, in any course. It just isn't there.
Always a big difference between theory and practice.
Yeah.
So I've been privileged to be involved in two multi-generational groups virtually over the last 2 years, and I've become keenly aware that learning is a two-way street. So I learn as much from the younger people and probably more than they learned from me and my colleagues. What have you found that parents and grandparents can learn from 20-somethings and teenagers?
Oh my goodness. We are so set on certain societal expectations, and I think they are much more open to not hitting milestones at certain dates. And much more open to experiences. This is a cliche now, but they are more open to experiences versus material things. When I grew up in the 80s, and I remember my mom, like her favorite activity, her sport was shopping. And it was fun. Granted, you know, it was a time we had different kind of resources. Although I would say now we have it, we just spend it on iPhones. But they're much more open to doing things rather than having things. They're not as into these labels. Like I said, my stepdaughter, God forbid she doesn't have the best iPhone, but she cares nothing for clothing. And plenty of people care about clothing. I'm just saying that it's not as driven. And also they value uniqueness and their own, I hate to say personal brand, but personal brands become code for acceptance and loving themselves and not feeling pressured to fit into a certain group. Almost being an individual has almost become the conformity, if that makes sense, that they are much less afraid of accepting who they are and they're much more accepting of other people. I see that I have a 14-year-old and I see that he is very open. I don't want to say there's all this talk about how to talk about sexuality in school and stuff, but like, he's just like, he doesn't think it's just part of the language. Like, oh yeah, his dad is gay. Oh yeah, this or whatever. My brother happens to be gay. No, you know, he just doesn't care. They just don't get hung up on these like labels like we do. They're very accepting of whatever. They're just much more open-minded and it's not as difficult for them, I think, to just accept people. And I think that's a really lovely thing about them. And they don't have these sort of specific expectations for their life. Again, sometimes decision fatigue though, because they are not being pushed into a certain lane, mostly good, but sometimes people want a little more structure. I think this generation, maybe that's where I'm getting at, Joe. I think maybe they're a little less structured in terms of their life expectations. They don't feel they have to get married by, my mom was 24 and she thought she was ancient at the time. Her father had passed away. So she had the ability to go travel for 2 years, which she wouldn't have been able to do had her father been alive in college or right out of college. That would have been it. So they have so much more freedom, but the freedom can be fraught because they don't have that support system sometimes.
So I'm writing your second book. I'm curious, what did you learn in writing the second one that builds on your knowledge from the first?
So the second one was very introspective because I had to be very honest about my own experiences. I mean, both books are honest, but I guess I revealed a lot more about my personal experiences, my feelings that maybe I disappointed my father. He's actually been calling me recently and saying, no, I really am proud of you. I really am proud of you, because he was disappointed that I didn't go to work on Wall Street. I think at the end of the day, he said, look, you have these journalism skills. Why won't you be a research analyst at a Wall Street firm and make multiples more money? And I just didn't want to do it. I didn't want the lifestyle. I wasn't interested in that way. So I was very vulnerable in the book. I also talk about shortcomings as a parent and my own frustrations and feelings of inadequacy. And I hope that people can relate to that. The first book, it's a series of interviews. I did it when I was, as I said, full-time at Reuters. I did get their permission and the ethics group was constantly in contact with me, but I was a full-time employee there. So I had to be very careful. I was very restricted in what I could say. And I did interview basically business celebrities and ask them about their moments, their sort of aha moments when they knew that they sort of needed to pay attention to money. So, you know, I had Tony Robbins in there. As I mentioned, Kevin O'Leary, designer Cynthia Rowley. I even managed to snag an interview with Drew Barrymore, the actress who is quite the businesswoman. So that was just a totally different book. And it was really meant to inspire young people. There's some information between these interviews, but it was sort of a fun flip through. Oh, isn't this interesting what Sally Krawcheck said and this aha moment that she had. And they're just incredible stories, but it wasn't personal the way this one is personal. And also this one, I think, solves the problem that I have and that a lot of other parents have, which is we're just not going to cut our kids off at 18 the way there's a stereotype. It's not realistic. Even if you say you want to do that, I don't know. Maybe some people do. I'm sure some people do. But the audience for this book are people like me that the greater danger is that we just keep over-subsidizing them and doing what I call concierge parenting, which is basically being available at all times to solve all problems, often using money. And so I really found myself needing help. And I'm a CFP. I mean, I had the information, but that's not what this is about. I mean, I have the information for people here. Or places to get it. But there's financial therapists in this book. There's a reason for that.
There's emotion involved.
Yes. Yes. It's tough to, you know, it's just like when you invest in stocks, you have to really step back. And that's why I always like having, even I have third party people managing most of my money, because sometimes you get emotion gets in the way of making rational decisions regarding your investments. So it's really good to have that sort of moment of clarity.
And there's nothing more humbling than parenting.
Yes. Oh my goodness. Yep.
So last question, if we could, what are the key things that parents and grandparents can do to help young adults achieve financial independence?
I think it's really important to let them drive. Let your help be driven by their goals and really listen to them and understand that their goals may evolve and change as they go through life. And people do change. People do grow up. People do mature. And they might not be ready to hear some things that you want them to be understanding. You have to give them the time and space to grow up a little bit. And maturing is hard. Growing up is hard. Stereotypically, we think of adults as age 18, maybe call it 22, because that's when a lot of kids graduate college. This book is for, I call them almost adults, parents of almost adults up to age 26. So I'm giving people an extra 4 years to sort of exit strategy their kids, whatever you want to call it, to launch their kids, I guess. Really, launch is the best word if you edit this. I'm giving people till 26 to launch their kids, even though on paper it might be 22 or even 18, because, you know, we do have Obamacare till 26. So we do have financial ties to our kids in many circumstances. And, you know, it's a joke. Netflix is now cracking down on these family plans. But you know what? I would not buy an extra Netflix subscription if I didn't need to, because again, we've got this family ecosystem. Like, why should we create extra expenses? And a generation ago, this literally didn't exist. Like, there was no Netflix. There was no cell phones. So we weren't discussing staying on the same phone plan. You had a landline and your kids got another landline in their home when they moved out, or they shared your phone. or you had call weeding, whatever it may be. So these are really new things and things have changed. And so we can't just be like, well, when I was your age, I'd moved out at 22 or whatever. I moved home at 22 for 6 months and it was humiliating, humiliating at the time in the early 90s, right? Now people are like, oh, that's so smart. She moved home. She's saving money. Great. So our lens has changed and we have to remember that, give our kids the support and love that they need, give them the space to figure it out, but also make sure that we have guardrails up and we are clear with our expectations. There's a very big difference between letting your kid just be a slacker hanging out at home or letting them use your resource of living rent-free to help them get a head start on their goals and their achievements and what they want to do with their life. And you have every right to be checking in with them, including looking at their money, if they are using your resources to do so, because you want to be in touch. You don't want to just say, oh, sure, stay at home as long as you need. I mean, that's the truth, right? None of us are really going to kick our kids out, but you need to set those expectations and they can be high. And kids love that. They respond to that. Let them know you believe in them. And that's going to go a long way towards their success.
Well said. Thank you so much, Bobby. Really appreciate the time you spent with us and great knowledge and wisdom to share with us on this topic.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of the podcast and I can't wait to keep listening.
Thanks. Same here. Take care.
So what's your to-do list following this conversation? Here are three ideas to think about. Number one, wait until it matters to them. I think Bobby's advice is spot on. Our advice, our wisdom, our experience won't matter if they're not ready to hear us. So wait for the moments that matter. First paycheck, first job out of college, first apartment, etc. And wait to come in when it's going to count. Number two, let them drive. This is another one that's easier said than done, but let's face it, if you're listening to this podcast, you've probably already helped them learn how to actually drive. So here, let them learn from their own experience. Let them experience what it's like to do the homework, to consider the options, to make the call, and make any adjustments that come from it later. Let them own the decisions with your help, but let them be the drivers. Number three, go on a mentor tour. This applies both to you in advising your children, but maybe also for yourself if you're considering doing something else after your primary career. There are plenty of people who can help you and give you advice. Bobby shared her experience earlier in our conversation. When I transitioned from an HR career to becoming a coach, I interviewed 21 of the best executive coaches in the field. They were very gracious with their time in person, pre-COVID, and people are willing to help. In the work I do, using the Designing Life process, my clients do exactly the same thing. So think about a mentor tour. Thanks for listening, and keep an eye out for a new episode coming your way on Monday.
Just one more thing before you take off. Is it time to design your new life after you graduate from the world of full-time work? Go to retirementwisdom.com and schedule a call today with Joe Casey. Working with an experienced coach like Joe can help you explore new possibilities and gain clarity on your future. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. See you next week.